It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel, all at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Good day or good evening, wherever you may be. And welcome to the RTC Weekly Download. I am Vlad. Some of you may recall I guest hosted around this time last year, and I am guest hosting again this year. So here I am, and I have some delightfully spooky old-time radio for you, including someone who died of fright, a most peculiar child attendant, a show dealing with a topic of special interest to me, and finally, a horrific tale that is inspired by a true story. But first, have you ever wondered about the human nature to be afraid of the dark? Come with me, if you dare, and explore the origin of the personification of that fear, the boogeyman.
Superstition on the air.
Gentlemen, it is our pleasure to offer you another short story in the series designed to disclose the origins of superstition. This time, we invade the nursery and reveal the origin of the terror of children, the boogeyman.
Daddy, stop! I'll never get this scarf finished if you keep pulling at it. Now, if you don't stop bothering me, I'll tell the boogeyman to get you when you're in the dark by yourself.
Oh, no, Dorothy. Please don't tell the boogeyman.
Why, Dorothy, you shouldn't frighten your little sister like that.
Auntie Helen, please ask Dorothy not to let the boogeyman get me.
No, Betty, dear. There's no such thing as a boogeyman. Don't think about it anymore. Now run along to Grandma's room and visit with her.
All right, Aunt Helen.
Dorothy, dear, I'm surprised at you. You're old enough to know better than to put such a dreadful thought on your little sister's mind. Do you realize that it makes a deep impression on a sensitive child, instilling a fear of the dark that sometimes takes years to eradicate?
But it's the only thing that'll make her stop annoying me, Aunt Helene.
Well, you should try some other means of making her behave. For it was just such a thought as that that frightened a child to death hundreds of years ago and started that belief in the boogeyman.
Why? How was that, Aunt Helene?
Well, it has to do with an incident that took place in a little village in Serbia. Oh, about the latter part of the 9th century, I should think. It was soon after the majority of the people had been converted to Christianity. However, before that, they had believed in their own gods of nature. But when they accepted the supreme god that the Christ had proclaimed, they discarded their old gods, or bogs, as they called them.
Bogs? Why, that's almost like boogie.
Yes. That's what the word boogie is derived from. For as the belief was spread into different countries, the word changed slightly from time to time to boog, boogle-boo, boogie, and various other forms.
Why, how interesting, Aunt Helene.
Yes, isn't it? But to go on. Among the people were some who were not converted to the new faith. They continued to believe in the old god of their ancestors, the god of the sun, the bog, as he was called. These people used to meet secretly in the mountains to worship him. They even sacrificed innocent victims to gratify the demands of the bog, hoping to secure his favor and bring good to themselves.
You mean they killed human beings as a sacrifice, Aunt Helene?
That's right, Dorothy. Now it so happened that there had been a storm that had lasted for some days, and the sun had been hidden from view. The worshippers of Debog believed that he was angry with them and demanded a sacrifice. So one night, their leader, whose name was Dushan, called them to meet in their secret place in the mountains so that they might offer up a sacrifice to appease the wrath of their god. And...
Listen, my people. The mighty wrath of Debog is upon us. For days he has not shown us his face. He is displeased with us. We must make sacrifice or he will forsake us.
Hey, Dushan. What shall we do to appease the powerful Bog of the Sun?
We must sacrifice one who is innocent and pure, a child of tender years.
Aye, Dushan, and I know of such a child.
Stand forth, Connor. Speak. Tell us where we may find her.
She is Malina, the youngest daughter of Stefan, a devout Christian. The wealthiest man in the village of Kuva, that is at the foot of these mountains.
Ah, the child of Stefan. You hate Stefan, eh, Kara? Ever since he caught you in dishonest bargaining with him?
Aye. And I hate him because he's a Christian, too, Dushan.
Good, Kara. Then Stefan's child shall be our sacrifice.
Aye, Dushan.
You, Kara, shall go after her, for you know how the interior of the house is arranged. Kaloyan and Vukhan will assist you.
But, Dushan, what if all doth not go well and the Christians should recognize me?
Do not fear, Kara. I have prepared for that. You shall wear the horrible mask of the Bog of Darkness. Then, should anything go amiss, you have only to pretend that you are the Bog himself.
Aye, thou art wise, Dushan. At last I will have my revenge.
Now this is what you three must do. When you are certain that the child is in bed and asleep, you, Kara, climb through the window into the child's room, seize her and pass her out the window into the arms of Kaloyan and Vukhan. Then secure the girl in this goatskin and hurry back so we can make sacrifice to the Bog at break of day.
Tis well, Dushan.
Take care, Kara, that no suspicion fall upon us. Away then and make haste. For the wrath of the Bog doth grow more great. We must gratify him.
We go, Dushan, to the house of Stefan for our sacrifice.
And may the Bog assist you.
Stefan, my husband.
Yes, Becca. What is it?
Our little one, Melina, will not go to bed.
It is late. It is long past her bedtime. What is the matter with her?
She is afraid of the dark, Stefan.
Such nonsense. Come, Melina, tell your father and mother why you are afraid of the dark.
When Mara and I were playing in the pasture today, Father, the old woman Melitza stopped us and told us if we did not pray to Debog, he would send the Bog of Darkness to punish us.
What? That old sorceress Melitza said that? Then it is true what they say in the village, that old Melitza does not believe in the God of the Christ.
Yes, and she said he'd eat us up with his big mouth that covers most of his face if we didn't.
No, no, Milena, my child, you must not believe that.
What old Melitza has told you, my daughter, is not true. Do not think of it anymore. Put it to bed, Draga.
Come, Melina. Say good night to your father and to the rest of the family.
Good night, Father. Good night, all of you.
Good night, Melina.
Good night, little sister.
Good night, Melina.
Oh, how cold it is in this bedroom, Mother dear.
Well, hurry. Let me undress you quickly and tuck you into bed. Then you'll be snug and warm.
How much noise the sky makes, Mother. Oh, I'm afraid. Don't leave me.
We will be close by you, darling. In the room right next to you.
But it will be so dark when you go, and I'm afraid of the Bog.
Nonsense, Melina. You have never been like this before. Now stop talking of such a thing. Into bed with you. There. Now let me tuck you in. Now, isn't that nice?
Oh, but I don't want you to leave me, Mother. Please. I'm so afraid.
Mother has work to do yet to prepare for the feast tomorrow. Besides, if you just say your prayers, the Supreme God will protect you from any harm. Now kiss me. Be a good girl. And go to sleep.
Oh, I'm so afraid, Mother. The bug might hurt me.
Hush. Now go to sleep, Melina. Good night, dear.
At last, brothers. The mother has left the room. The child is now in bed. Here's our chance. Help me to get through the window.
But, Kara, it is too soon. Why not wait till the child falls asleep? She may scream if she sees you.
Nay, Kaloyan, we must hurry. Do not fear, for I will be careful. Come, help me.
Very well, Kara. Vukan and I will stand close to the window and seize the child as you pass her out to us. Come, Vukan. Let us lift Kara through the window.
There, Kaloyan, he is in. I hope he hurries. If we should get caught by these Christians, it would mean death to us.
Nay, do not fear, Vukan. We have the power of Dubab with us.
Mother,
what is it, Melina? Stefan! Stefan! Look! That horrible creature!
Where? Oh, I see it. I saw it then in the flash of lightning near the window. It's a bug of darkness, Draga. Quick, Michael, a light!
Melina! Melina! Child! Speak to me! Speak!
Here's the light, Stefan.
The bog is gone. Michael, Nicholas, Venka, hurry. Search the ground to see if you can find any trace of him.
Yay, Stefan.
Melina!
What's the matter, Draga?
Oh, Stefan, I cannot rouse Melina. She is dead.
Dead? Alas, then, the bog of darkness has left his mark.
Oh. And so, because of the storm that washed away any trace of the footprints of Kara and his companions, the people believed that it had been the bog of darkness that had been there and killed the child, then vanished into thin air. But as in reality, the child had died of fright. So gradually, the belief in the boogeyman was spread about into other countries and has remained even unto this day. Now, you see how ridiculous it is to say such a thing, Dorothy.
Ridiculous? But I don't see anything ridiculous in that. After all, the little child died.
Yes, but Dorothy, don't you see? If that old woman had not told Melina that the bog would get her, she wouldn't have been so terrified at the dark. But because that thought possessed her mind so strongly, anything that had come into her room would have affected her in the same way. For she was worked up to such a terrific pitch that the strain was too much for her delicate heart, and she died of fright.
Yes, Aunt Helena, that's true, but I...
Aunt Helene, Mother says I gotta go to bed now, and I don't want to, because I'm afraid of the boogeyman.
That's nonsense, Betty. Now, you go up to bed like a good girl.
No, I won't go unless Dorothy comes too.
Well, I'm not coming. I'm going out with Tom this evening.
Well, I'll come with you, Bertie.
No, no. I want Dorothy. She knows the boogeyman and you don't. And she can tell him to leave me alone. I won't go without Dorothy.
Oh, good heavens. You're a perfect nuisance.
You see, Dorothy, now will you ever tell Betty about the boogeyman again, my dear?
I should say not.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, Dorothy probably means what she says and will not tell little Betty about the boogeyman anymore. That is, not until she gets provoked again. Well, au revoir and good luck to you.
Thank you.
had the feeling that you were being watched? That sensation one gets as though just beyond the field of vision, eyes are following every move you make. Has it happened to you? My next program is about a man. A man plagued by a most unusual object. And it is called the Babysitter.
It's The Babysitter by Alison Prince.
Nigel's mother came into his bedroom to kiss him goodnight. "You will be good, won't you?" she said. "Mr. Pope is a dear old man. It was so sweet of him to offer to babysit." "Well, I don't like him much. Why couldn't Auntie Betty come?" asked Nigel, frowning. "I told you," said his mother patiently. "Auntie Betty's ill, and Mr. Pope has offered to babysit ever so many times." She bent and kissed Nigel. "Be good." "Well, tell him I want a story," Nigel shouted after her. Doors banged, and Nigel heard the car start and drive away. Suddenly, he felt very lonely. The sitting room door opened. Mr. Pope came out and started to climb the stairs, his footsteps as slow and measured as they were when he plodded down the garden path. Mr. Pope opened the bedroom door. "Your mother tells me you want a story," he announced. Nigel sniffed. "Yes, please," he said. Mr. Pope smiled slowly. "Well, I'm glad about that," he said, "because I've been thinking for a long time about a story I'd like to tell you." He brought a chair to Nigel's bedside and sat down. Nigel stared up at him, fascinated and slightly afraid. Mr. Pope's face never quite seemed to go with the big, rough hands. It was a hollow face, Nigel thought. But the strangest thing about him was his eyes. Mr. Pope's eyes were very pale blue, and he never seemed to blink. He gazed ahead of him with an unwavering, pink-rimmed stare, which never quite fixed on the thing he was looking at. Tonight, Mr. Pope's eyes were as unblinking as ever, and as Nigel stared up at him, he could see the tiny network of veins which threaded the whites of the eyes, surrounding the sky-blue circles of the irises with wriggly red lines. "Now, this is a true story, boy, every word of it. Afterwards, you must never think to yourself that I made it up. This is the first time I've ever told this story, and I shall never tell it again, not to a living soul. This is your story, boy, just for you." "Oh, thank you," said Nigel. "Yes," Mr. Pope went on. "I've waited for years for this, to find the right person." "And it's me?" asked Nigel, pleased. "It's you," agreed Mr. Pope. "What's it called?" asked Nigel. Mr. Pope thought. "I never gave it a name," he said, "but I suppose I'd call it Hackie Basham's Glass Eye." "Hackie Basham," he said. "Got his name because he coughed. Terrible hacking cough it was. That's why we called him Hackie. Hackie seemed an old man to us kids," Mr. Pope continued, "though I dare say he wasn't much above 40. He'd been gassed in the First World War, you see, boy, and that had ruined him. His hair turned white, and he never hardly worked again through having such a cough. And he lost his eye." "How awful," said Nigel. "Did he just have a hole?" "He did," said Mr. Pope. "But he had a glass eye that fitted in it. Except that it didn't move, you'd never have known it wasn't real." "What colour was it?" inquired Nigel. "Blue," said Mr. Pope. "The same as the other one, just like mine and yours, boy." "In those days," Mr. Pope went on, "people didn't go in so much for babysitters, but my mum and dad were the careful sort, and if they went to the pictures, they'd ask Hackie Basham to keep an eye on me. But just how he kept an eye on me, they never knew."
"How did he?"
asked Nigel. "Well, when I was tucked up in bed," said Mr. Pope, "like you are now, boy, Hackie had come upstairs, coughing fit to bust, and he'd come into the room and stand there, wheezing, and he'd say, 'I'm going to keep an eye on you, boy.' And he'd take out his glass eye and put it on the mantelpiece, right on the edge, so it was looking at me. 'If you're naughty,' he'd say,
My eye'll tell me. It always does. And he'd go off downstairs laughing and coughing, and the eye would look at me. Even in the dark, I could see it, because there was a street lamp outside.
How awful,
said Nigel. Well, that was just the beginning, went on Mr. Pope. One night, my cousin Jack had come to stay. He was sleeping in my room on a camp bed, and I was glad of his company because my mum and dad were going out that night.
Did Hecky Basham come? Asked Nigel.
He did, said Mr. Pope grimly. And he put his eye on the mantelpiece and went downstairs, laughing and coughing like always. Now, Jack was older than me, and he said, here, he said, we'll give the old boy a dose of his own medicine. Frighten him for a change. We lied it. And he made me put the bedclothes over my head so I wouldn't see where he put it.
What happened? Breathed Nigel.
I lay there with a sheet over my head, said Mr. Pope, and I listened to Jack moving about, looking for a good hiding place. I heard him open drawers and shut them again. Then he pulled the door of the wardrobe open. Then he shut that. And then he opened the window and shut it again. You can come out now, he said to me. And he was grinning all over his face. You haven't thrown it out in the street, have you? I asked him. And he just laughed. And he wouldn't tell me. Anyway, Mr. Pope went on, Jack went to sleep. I kept thinking about the eye, hidden somewhere and still looking at me from wherever it was, and I couldn't go to sleep. Then Hacky came upstairs. When he stopped coughing, he looked on the mantelpiece, and then he came over to my bed. Where is it? He whispered. I told him I didn't know. He bent over my bed with his mouth right close to my ear. Whoever took it, he said, will come to a bad end very soon. But you, my boy, I'll keep an eye on you forever. Well, next morning, Jack looked outside for the eye. There was a window box on our sill, and Jack had put the eye in there, wedged in the earth among the petunias. But it had gone.
Oh, how odd, said Nigel.
Mr. Pope ignored him. When my cousin Jack was going home that morning, he went on, he slipped on the wet road and fell under a tram. Killed him stone dead.
No,
gasped Nigel. And that night, when I went to bed, the eye was on my mantelpiece. He held up his hand as if to ward off any questions. Hacky Basham hadn't been to the house. He never came again. An infection set in that very day in the eye socket, went through to his brain and killed him.
Mr. Pope stared through Nigel again with his pale blue eyes.
I was haunted, boy. I've been haunted from that day to this.
What do you mean?
Asked Nigel nervously. Hacky Basham's glass eye never left me from that day onwards, said Mr. Pope. It was always there looking at me. I never knew where it would be. If I took out my sandwiches when I went fishing, there it was in the package looking like a hard-boiled egg until it rolled over and stared up at me. If I got on a bus and felt in my pocket for the fare, the eye would be there among the pennies waiting for me to put my hand on it.
But how did it get there? Asked Nigel.
I wish I knew, said Mr. Pope. It was no good hiding it. I put it in me drawer along with me socks once when I'd asked a girl to come to the pictures with me. I bought her a packet of peanuts in the interval, and when she opened them, there with the eye staring up at her, she screamed the place down. She dropped the eye on the floor before she ran out of the cinema. And that night, it was back on my mantelpiece.
I don't think it's a very nice story, said Nigel.
But it's a very special story, Nigel, said Mr. Pope, gazing at him with the fish-cold blue eyes. Oh, yes, the eye ruined my life. I never married, frightened off every girl I met, and it lost me job after job by turning up at the wrong moment.
Well, I'd have told my mother, said Nigel stoutly. She'd know what to do.
Oh, I tried that, said Mr. Pope. I held it out to her on the palm of my hand and said, "Mum, this is Mr. Basham's glass eye." And she looked straight at it and said, "Oh, don't be silly, dear, there's nothing there." And Dad couldn't see it either. They went to a doctor about me after a bit, thought I was nuts. I had to pretend I couldn't see it anymore, or they'd have put me in the madhouse. Nigel gulped. What happened? He asked. In the end, I mean. "Oh, I don't know yet," said Mr. Pope. "That's up to you." He felt in his pocket and brought something out in his closed fist. Nigel stared at the scarred knuckles and knew what they hid. "Oh, don't," he said. Mr. Pope turned his hand over and opened the fingers. There on the palm lay the glass eye, the pale blue iris pointing directly at Nigel, staring at him with a hard, wide-open, black-centered stare. Tiny veins of red threaded the china-white ball, exactly like those in Mr. Pope's own eyes. Nigel couldn't look away.
"You can see it, can't you, boy?" said Mr. Pope.
Nigel nodded, speechless. Mr. Pope got up slowly and put the eye on the mantelpiece.
"There," he said with a dry chuckle. "Now it'll keep an eye on you."
And then he sighed, a small, happy sigh.
"Peace at last," he said. "After a haunted lifetime. Oh, I'm grateful to you, boy. Grateful."
And suddenly a spasm of violent coughing shook him. Nigel had never heard Mr. Pope cough like that before. He'd never heard him cough at all. It sounded as if the man's lungs were being torn into shreds, so destructive was the fit. Mr. Pope lurched out of the room, and Nigel lay back in relief. He heard Mr. Pope stagger down the stairs, still coughing. Then the coughing gave way to a burst of wild, harsh laughter. After that, there was a tumbling crash, as though the man had fallen down the last few steps of the stairs. Then there was silence. Nigel cowered in his bed, and the glass eye on the mantelpiece stared down at him with an implacable blue gaze. It seemed a lifetime before Nigel heard the car come into the garage. A key scratched in the front door. Nigel's mother gave a shriek of horror as she came into the hall. Nigel heard his father say, "Oh, my God, poor old boy." And then his mother came running up the stairs.
"Mummy!"
screamed Nigel.
"Mummy!"
His mother rushed in and hugged him in trembling arms. "The eye, Mummy," begged Nigel. "Take the eye away!"
"Nigel, dear," said his mother. "It's all right. Mr. Pope is... well, he's had a little accident. But everything's all right now. No need to worry. Mummy's here."
It was quite obvious that Mr. Pope was dead. But that wasn't what mattered. Nigel took a deep breath. "Mummy," he said carefully, "listen. Please take that eye away. Hackie Basham's glass eye. It's on the mantelpiece. Look." Nigel's mother turned her head to follow the direction of his pointing hand. Nigel glanced again at the round white eye that stared at him with its blue triumphant gaze from the mantelpiece and said irritably, "Why don't you take it away?" "Nigel," said his mother gently, "darling, there's nothing there."
The Babysitter was read by Hayden Jones and produced by Dan Garrett.
It seems that Hackie Basham's glass eye claims yet another victim. C'est la vie, as they say. My next program comes from the Halloween broadcast of station WKBW in 1973. In addition to their own adaptation of War of the Worlds and a few other spooky programs, there is this program on the subject of vampires, which, you may have guessed, is of particular interest to me.
Mm-hmm.
the world, vampires have existed in both legend and fact. Since time began, the superstition of men has led them to believe that other men arose from the grave in a restless and eternal prowling that could only be satiated by the sucking of a living victim's blood. Remarkably, there have been living men, no specters, but living men that have succumbed to this superstition and in their deranged minds believe themselves to be vampires. The list of men in the countries they represent is endless. Tonight, we'll look at some of those superstitions, their origins, causes of some of them, and we'll hear an original vampire drama. This is Halloween Night on WKBW Radio in Buffalo. I'm Jim McGrath. In the year 1733, John Heinrich Zupfius, a German scientist fascinated with the occult world, described vampires as those that issue from their graves in the night, attacking people who are sleeping in their beds, sucking all the blood from their bodies, and destroying them. Now, as any self-respecting vampire will tell you, and as vampire lore will bear out, vampires did not always take enough blood from a person to kill them. Victims of vampires, or those suspected of being victims of vampires, often complained of a lassitude, no energy, tired, run down, iron, poor blood. The vampire sometimes made several visits to the same victim, especially if they were attractive young ladies. Zupfius points out in a later chapter of his book that victims that lingered often volunteered at the point of death that someone who had lately died had risen from their tomb to torment, torture, and kill them. A more contemporary definition of a vampire can be found in Webster. A blood-sucking ghost or reanimated body of a dead person, believed to come from the grave and wander about by night, sucking the blood of persons asleep and causing their deaths. Webster apparently feels much more definite about the mortality rate than Zupfius does. Blood, of course, is the overriding factor of vampirism. As this material was researched, the writer was faced with great gouts of blood and gore. It gets a little sticky. But blood plays a key role in the origins of the vampire myth. Superstition is rampant, and many historians report that early superstitions were fostered by the church at the dawn of Christianity because they damned it as the work of the devil, therefore giving credence to what might have been described as old wives' tales. Christians, however, take wine at their communion services representing the blood of Christ. The Jews, although forbidden to consume blood, pour it on the ground in sacrificial rites to return its strength to the soil. Pagan warriors often licked it from their spears or drank it from their opponents to absorb his strength into their own bodies. The explanations for the vampire theory are many. They begin with cannibalism.
This is Arlene Bunis. Since the dawn of time, people have quite literally eaten one another. For what purpose? Because they were hungry. But that's only one part of the answer. Many times it was in sacrificial and religious rites. As time passed and man became more intelligent and sophisticated, his respect for himself made him loath to eat his neighbor. This has reduced cannibalism to a minimum in civilized countries.
Arlene, if our research is correct, that last known case of cannibalism in the United States is the one of the party of settlers trapped in the high Sierra Mountains of California at the Donner Pass. Snowed in, about to die from cold, exhaustion, and hunger, they were forced to consume members of their party who had already died. There's no doubt that this practice saved the lives of many of the trapped people who survived till the spring and made their way out to tell their grisly story. You have to wonder if, blindfolded, could you tell the difference between steak Diane and thigh flambé? Cannibalism and vampirism often mix, as in the famous case of the monster of Montlure, Martin de Mallard, just at the turn of the 20th century. We'll hear that in 60 seconds. Montlure, France, 1888. Justine Lafayette and Martin de Mallard marry, and the countryside is ravaged with an outbreak of cannibalism and vampirism.
Martin de Mallard is a young man, handsome and devil-may-care.
Justine is a huge slab of a woman, prone to use drugs and revel in all forms of excess. Justine, as grotesque a creature that you would hope to find, could never in her wildest dreams expect young Martin to marry her. Martin is the rake of the town, and although he's shunned by wily parents, he's the apple of the eye of many of the young maidens. The story unfolds in this way. Justine. Fat, ugly, mustachioed woman that she is, drugs young Martin and introduces him to the arts of the occult, black masses, fetishism, all the things she delights in. Unfortunately for the young man, his mind is not capable of withstanding the assault of Justine, aided by the continued use of drugs, and he snaps. Somewhere, deep in his mind, is a desire for flesh and blood. He makes his first kill, a 15-year-old girl behind a warehouse, slits her throat and drinks. The body is discovered drained of life's fluid, and neat, precise cuts taken from the arms and legs. Now, a rain of terror falls over the quiet French town that reduces the streets to echo carriers after nightfall. For the next 5 years, Martin would strike more than 80 times. Each time, the same discovery. The blood drained, the flesh cut away. Finally, they are caught. Justine had waxed even fatter on her unusual diet. And Martin was a slaughtering animal, devoid of any sense, any at all, a vegetable. Martin was in a very real sense a vampire. A human, as opposed to the dictionary definition type of being risen from the grave, to be sure, but nevertheless, a vampire. Although incidents like this are scattered in countries throughout the world, the very heart of the vampire legend, made its strongest foothold in the Balkan countries. It still exists today, as deeply as it did years and years ago.
It's known that Eastern European peasants would open a grave after a period of time had passed to examine the body and determine whether or not the corpse has ascended to a better life. Not the soul, but the corpse. Discovering the corpse still in the grave led to all kinds of speculation about the life that the dead person had led while alive, and the fact that he was either going to suffer eternal damnation for his sins or would assume some other form of hellish existence. Understand that it was not uncommon for people to be buried alive at this time. Medical procedures, when available, which they most likely were not in the small villages, were hopelessly inadequate. Diagnosis and treatment were largely farm remedies, and an individual suffering a stroke or a coma could be easily mistaken for dead and buried.
Then comes the exhumation party to see if the dead one has gone to heaven. Open the grave. Five.
open the lid of the coffin. And now the real corpse is found in a different position. The shroud is torn and bloody, and often the fingertips, arms, and shoulders were bitten and gouged, and the coffin was filled with gore. Signs of a terrible struggle for freedom. This unfortunate person would then be represented as a blood-sucking vampire, or the victim of a vampire. Here was evidence in the minds of the villagers that a vampire had struck and had claimed this one as his own. It never occurred to them that it was the claustrophobic ragings of hopelessness that caused the biting and face-tearing in the struggle for air and land. The case histories go on and on. Hungary, 1856. Here it is customary to bury people in rows, one grave right next to another. A man dies of a strange malady and is buried. The next day, the gravedigger is preparing another pit when sounds of knocking are heard. Terrified, he reports it to the authorities, who at last get permission to open the grave and exhume the body. By the time this had been accomplished, the man had died in reality. The shroud is torn and bloodied. The man's body had been bitten and the coffin filled with his blood. The vampire's victim? Gypsies deep in the Carpathian Mountains believe that there are ways to determine the grave sites of vampires and ways to kill them. We'll explore those in a moment. The vampire throughout the world can be divided into two categories.
The spirit of a dead person is the first, rising ethereally like a mist from the grave and materializing into skin and bones, or taking the form of a bat or a wolf, most commonly a werewolf in Transylvania, transfixing the intended victim with fear, either through the sheer apparition it presents, or more often through hypnosis. The bat would always materialize into human form. Not so in the case of the werewolf, who was far down the cultural vampire ladder. The werewolf being somewhat untidy and prone to eat flesh as well as drink blood.
The second manifestation is a corpse who, reanimated by his own spirit or that of a demon, returns to suck the life of the living in order to maintain its own vitality. This legend was helped along by premature burial and exhumation. It's only natural you should die from loss of blood, says the peasant. Isn't it logical that you could be reborn by drinking it? The vampire always inhabited a grave, regardless of whether he was of the spirit category or the risen dead. Gypsy lore tells us that you can find a vampire grave by looking for the following things. Several holes above the head of the grave, about the width of a man's finger. There's no explanation for these holes or why they should be there. Presumably they are there for escape. Does the revealed corpse have
wide open eyes?
Ruddy complexion.
Nails and hair growing in light.
Are there marks on the neck or shoulders?
Is the shroud partially devoured?
Are the limbs flexible?
Is there blood in the coffin?
Sound familiar? All signs of premature death and burial. Or are they? There are other ways of discovering a vampire's grave.
A young, virtuous boy is placed on the back of a maiden mare, and the horse is led over the suspected graves, almost always fresh ones. If the horse crosses the grave without difficulty, all is well. If the mayor should shy away from it, there is your vampire.
Once discovered, what do you do with a vampire? You drive a wooden stake through the heart. But the wood must come from maple, aspen, hawthorn, or blackthorn tree. You can impale the body on a stake. You can drive a common metal stake through the heart. This will only serve to keep the vampire in the coffin and not really destroy it. Should the stake be removed at a later date, the vampire would then be free to roam and terrorize the countryside again. And the first victim would be the luckless individual who pulled the stake from his heart.
Lopping off the head in upside-down suspension to drain the fluid from the body is another method. Shooting or stabbing through the heart with bullets or knives made of precious metals, gold and silver.
Tearing out the heart. Tearing is the most important word. In order for this to be effective, the heart must have been torn from the chest by hand, without the aid of any implement, and then either impaled on a wooden stake, stabbed with a silver or gold knife, shot with a silver or gold bullet, burned, and the ashes scattered, boiled in oil, or eaten by the village saint. The only thing wrong with the last is that the saint was likely to become a vampire as well. It depended on the strength of the faith of the individual, the watchfulness of his neighbors, and the depth of the local superstition. Burning the body was another method. But generally, any of these things that we have mentioned would do the job. And a combination of them was doubly effective.
In the Balkan countries, vampires do not cast shadows. The fact that the Balkan vampire came out only at night might contribute to this. They could only be destroyed by gypsies or witches, which was expensive and a long, drawn-out affair. How do you become a vampire? We'll take that up in a moment. Vampire, you must first and foremost be dead.
Well, that's essential. Mm-hmm.
To have committed suicide made you a prime candidate. To have been excommunicated by the church doubled your chances. Of course, a suicide case is automatically excommunicated, so how could you miss? And not to have received the full burial rites made your prospects of living on in the minds of your neighbors as a vampire extremely attractive. If the services had been interrupted by a death on the part of one of the celebrants, an occult occurrence, or to have had a bird rest on your coffin, or a horse cross your grave within minutes of burial, all the better. Strangely enough, children born on high holidays of the church were said to be prime candidates for vampirism. Stillborn children, of course, also fell into that category.
Those persons who have eaten the flesh of a sheep that was killed by a wolf were likely to become vampires. And those persons who had eaten the flesh of a sheep that was killed by a werewolf were doomed. You could only become a vampire if you were attacked by a vampire. Any of the reasons we mentioned before would enhance your chances of being attacked. Vampires were particularly attracted to young people and pretty girls. And as we said earlier, an attack did not necessarily lead to death. Several visits might be required before death came, especially if she were pretty. Those attacked by vampires while living were doomed to be vampires after death.
A woman in her sixth month of pregnancy, according to a Romanian legend, who was looked upon by a vampire, would bear a child that after death would become a vampire. If the child were a girl, she would be attacked repeatedly during life by the vampire and suffer no ill effects.
She would be, in our terms today, a service station until she suffered a natural death.
Children of vampires would be vampires. And if two successive children from the same family became vampires, then it was considered to be hereditary, and the village would discourage the mother from having more children by killing any that were born.
People who were loners, either witches or warlocks, stood an excellent chance of becoming vampires. A stunted leg or arm, any physical defect, made you a prime candidate. And if you were a little freaky, it was certain that the vampire would visit you either before or after death and inflict his curse. Can you imagine for a moment that such people, spirits, ethereal beings might exist? Can you let your imagination run and say, yes, it might be so? Or would you be practical and scholarly and say that it's not possible? I've never seen one. No one has. Do you for one moment imagine that we see the 100,000th part of what exists? Consider for a moment the wind, the greatest of the forces of nature. It knocks men down, demolishes houses, uproots trees, stirs up the sea, drives great ships on the rocks. The wind whistles and groans and bellows and howls and roars and screams and whines and whinnies and sometimes kills. Have you ever seen it? The wind. Imagination soar. Let your imagination carry you to the land of the Gypsies, the Moravians, the Slavs, Bohemia, Slovak, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, countries that harbor an intense obsession with superstition, countries where werewolves, witches, vampires, exist. Small villages with sod roofs and cranes and storks inhabiting abandoned chimneys and lofts, cobbled and earthen streets that rattle and jar, passing wagons and riders, and narrow lanes with squat trees that hunker by the roadside, reaching out over the road with twisted, gnarled arms and stiff, wooden fingers. And the people are like the trees, squat, flat-faced, and alike. Alike in all things, including fear. Night is descending, that time of day when shadows reach out and curl at you, a smooth, lingering caress that's cool and frightening. Neither light nor darkness, neither day nor night. Smoke trickles and eddies from the chimneys, and windows reflect brassily the light from within, and the eyes couched in fat pouches, in flinty skin, in a myriad of wrinkles, reflect the cold, flat glow of the moon as it rises over the mountains and the large house that sits astride them. As the light leaves the country, the vacuum is filled with a stirring that becomes a zephyr of air, that becomes a frost-laden breeze, that becomes a crack-seeking knife-edged wind, that becomes a storm-laden holocaust. Branches scratch at windows, and slowly eyes turn toward the sound. Shutters bang, and people jump. Drafts cause candles to flicker, and cold fingers of fear gently massage the base of your neck. A small bird tucks its head under its wing. And the people in the village and the houses tuck their heads under their covers to lose their fear in the oblivion of sleep. The storm continues through the night. At the windows and falls with a leaden sound on sod roofs. An immense rattle of wind, and she stirs. Sleep is her lover, loath to part. Gradually she sheds his embrace and opens her eyes. It's an awakening not to be associated with alarm, more like a lazy, full-furred cat reaching and stretching, first drawing the muscles tight, then relaxing them, but only for a moment. A sound. A stirring. A cold moment of fear. As a lightning flash catches a spectral form. A brief moment of light and then darkness. A wild blue, double fork of lightning crustles the air. Lights the gaping maw of the window, and she sees it. A bat. A bat on the window ledge. The small twittering sound as it flies again and again comes to rest on the window ledge. And once more it flies. And once more it returns. Again and again the small hairy creature utters its piercing little sound. Flies and returns. She thinks, up from the bed to frighten off the creature. The large double windows from the floor to the ceiling cast an eerie pall inward to the room, and the soft clinging gown she wears glues itself adhesively to her as she moves toward the window, extends her hand to the latch, and opens it. Savage bolt of lightning hurls itself, ripping and tearing through the ether, driving her back across the room, hand and arm upraised across her face to ward off the viciousness and explosiveness of it. Frightened, she careens into the side of the bed, falls backward across it, heart beating like a trip hammer. Breath coming in explosive bursts, eyes closed against the ferocity and fearsomeness of nature's angry bolts. Silence. Silence. The only sound, the quivering of her breath. Eyes closed, leaning back on the bed, she calms herself. Her breath becomes more regular. The heartbeat normal. The percussion of the storm is past. A small, whispering, wet quiet hangs over the room.
A tiny, soundless, ominous quiet.
Open your eyes.
Says her mind, and they struggle to open. She struggles to keep them closed. A small voice penetrates, and sightlessly she clamps her hands over her ears so as not to hear.
Open your eyes.
Says the voice.
See if it's still there. No, no.
She rails against the voice.
You want me to see something that will hurt me, something that will frighten me. No, no.
Like oil on water, her mind replies.
It's only a bat. You frighten it away. Open your eyes.
Bird-like, the lids flutter. The icy glare of a cold night moon shoots into the light. Starved iris, they contract and open and focus. And there, suspended in the middle of the window, wings beating slowly, was the bat. Not frightened, not gone, but waiting. A wild, blue, bewildering flash of lightning struck out at the earth for an instant, bringing out every color to be seen with terrible clarity. And in the echoes of the shattering boom, the bat changed form and stood before the window.
What is it?
Real. A delusion.
My God, what is it?
There was no sound from the spectral figure that loomed on the windowsill, not a murmur of wind, not a hint of cloud, not a trace of motion.
Am I awake? Am I awake?
Eyes shut tightly to ward off the evil. Her sense of hearing became acute, and she heard it. A chattering sound. Something hard scratching against the glass of the windows.
Look.
Said the mind.
No.
She breathed.
Look.
And she did. A tall apparition stands on the ledge of the window. Silhouetted brilliantly by a moon. So spherical, so bright. The fingernails of the specter probe the glass. Now the unlatched window slowly swings in. A soundless shriek for help. The figure steps in. Arms apart from the body, raised lightly. Fingers distended so the nails could be seen long, pointed and sharp. They tap at the window, and now the fingers flex and undulate, stirring small currents of air as the smell of death and blood waft over the girl, filling her with fear and terror. Small sounds, no sound anyone will hear. Tiny sound, no louder than the flapping of a butterfly's wings. She repeats the word as though in a dream, calling for help in another land. The harsh glare of the moon strikes the face of the creature as it half turns, lights it perfectly white. Perfectly bloodless. Tightly lined, the lips draw back, bearing the maw that displays fierce teeth. Hideously, glaringly white, and fang-like. The eyes, like leaden pewter, reflecting no light, glinting dully in the watery wash of the moon. And dance like the hands flutter and the nails show and the teeth glint, and she can only fight for consciousness and call feebly for help with a heart that beats so furiously it will burst the confines of its frail and beautiful chamber.
one brief moment, the light of consciousness extinguishes, and the beautiful body relaxes and slumps on the bed. A sliding, scurrying sound, and the vampire is there at the side of the bed, at the side of the girl, inches away from satiating his hunger, inches from the alabaster neck that presents itself to the hideous fangs. Scrabbling hands and overgrown filthy nails clear a stray lock of hair from her throat. A shooting comet of light lances upward into his eyes, those leaden pewter eyes that recoil in terror from the crucifix she wears. Blow. His head is thrown back, the mouth not filled with the blood of his victim, but with the sour bile of defeat, opens and shrieks soundlessly as he stumbles across the room, seeking escape from the tenacious beam that follows him. Soundlessly he gains the window ledge, and equally as soundlessly the apparition disappears with a small chattering sound in the beating of wings. Dawn's first light, the only reminder of the visitation in the big house, is the window, slightly ajar. In the village, the squat, flat-faced inhabitants stumble noiselessly from sleep, snorting and grunting. Another night has passed, and another day begins. Some have awakened, some will sleep on. Some sleep on from natural causes. Another, a young another, pretty but very pale, also sleeps. An investigation shows the two punctures in her neck to be the cause of her slumber. The family can recall no noise. Oh yes, a moment. The twittering of a bat just before dawn. Just before.
My final program for you comes from the series Lights Out, but holds a unique place in this lineup, since the story is inspired by a documented case of what some believe to be the first serial killer in the United States, and it is called Murder Castle.
We picked her up walking down the street saying the same thing over and over again. Why, she's as goofy as they come, I tell you. Listen to her yourself.
Revenge.
Yeah, listen to her, Captain.
Revenge.
Over and over again.
Revenge.
Such a young and pretty girl.
Revenge.
What could have driven her out of her mind like
revenge.
That, I ask you?
Revenge.
Yes? Yes, what is it?
I'm looking for a Mr. Henry Stewart, if you please.
Oh, you mean about the advertisement?
Yes, that's right. I got here as soon as I could.
That's all right, as long as you got here, that's all that matters. Come in.
Oh, thank you.
Just put your suitcase down there. It'll be all right.
Thank you.
Oh, now, if you'll come right this way.
Thank you.
Just step in here, Miss...
Malone. Ella Malone.
Oh, yes, of course. Miss Malone. Now then, you'll have a chair, please.
Oh, thank you.
There we are. Now then, Miss Malone, to be perfectly frank with you, I wasn't quite expecting you today.
Oh, I'm truly sorry, Mr. Stewart. But you see, I took the wrong train and Well, I had the hardest time finding the house. I do hope you'll forgive me.
Of course, of course. Don't give it another thought. Promptness may be a virtue, but we all can't be virtuous, now can we? Now then, you're here in answer to my advertisement.
Yes, sir. You wrote me.
Oh, yes, yes, of course. You're the young lady from...
From Queensville.
Oh, yes, Queensville. You have my letter with you?
Oh, yes, sir. Right here, sir.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now then, your friends know you came here, of course.
There's no one very much interested, Mr. Stewart.
Oh, come now. A pretty young girl like you, no young beaus, and so on, so on.
No, sir, there's no one. I mean, sir, you can depend on me to give all my attention to my work.
Very commendable indeed. My work, as I wrote you, is entirely confidential. My philanthropies are, to a great extent, entirely sub rosa, no fuss, no feathers. You understand what I mean?
Oh, yes, sir.
As my secretary, my affairs will be entirely in your hands. My checking account, my finances, and so on, so on. Entirely in your care.
I understand, sir.
It's quite a responsibility, and you're quite a young woman. And as I wrote you, the bank...
Oh, yes, sir, I understand. The bond, I brought the money for it, $300. I've got it right here, sir.
Oh, fine, fine. That's very businesslike, yes, indeed. I'll give you a receipt, and there we'll be.
Mr. Stewart.
Yes? Oh, my pen. Oh, yes, Anita, here we are.
My money. Will I get it back from the bank any time I leave your employ? I mean, when you want me to.
Hmm? Oh, yes, of course, of course. Now then, here we are. Received of Miss Nellie Malone.
Ella.
Oh, yes, of course, Ella. Memory isn't quite what it used to be. That's why I need a good secretary.
I'm very good at remembering things.
Oh, you are, you are. Now then, we are. Guess this receipt is in good order. Received of Miss Ella Malone. $300 to be deposited with the Merchants Bank as surety bond. And to be returned to said Ella Malone upon request. There's my signature. Now then, how's that?
I'm sure that'll do very well, sir.
Now, then, you have got my receipt. But I...
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Not at all, not at all.
Of course, I have it right here. I am sorry.
Oh, well, I understand. The excitement of your trip.
Here it is, Mr. Stewart. You see, I had it already in an envelope. Now, if you're open...
Oh, no, no, not at all, not at all. Bank can do that when I send it to them in the morning. Now, just put your purse down there, and I'll show you through your new home.
Yes, Mr. Stewart.
Now, we'll go right up these stairs.
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes, you find I have quite a place here. Three stories high, and every inch of it my own design.
Rather dark.
Oh, careful now, careful.
Oh, I'm all right.
Mustn't hurt yourself. Hardly the way to start a new job, is it? Now then, here we are. Got a nice room for you, very nice. Fact of the matter is, you can choose any room on this floor.
But, Mr. Stewart, your daughters...
Daughters?
Yes, won't they object? You said anything.
Oh, yes, yes, my daughters. I did write to you about them, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Well, never mind about them. They're upstairs studying. Now, right here. I suggest that you take this room, at least for the night.
Whatever you say, Mr. Stewart.
Get the light on. There we are. Nice, isn't it?
I've never had such a large room. If you've got one a little smaller...
On the contrary, my dear Miss Malone, you'll find this one small enough. Perhaps a little too small. Yes, indeed. Entirely too small.
But, Mr. Stewart... Locking the door. Mr. Stewart, why did you... Mr. Stewart, why did you lock the door? Mr. Stewart... Mr. Stewart, why have you shut me in here? Mr. Stewart, please... Please answer me. Mr. Stewart, please let me out of here. Mr. Stewart, please let me out of here.
Yes, yes, Miss Nord. There's no doubt in my mind at all that you're the very person I want to employ as my housekeeper.
I'm very glad to hear that, Mr. Stewart.
Of course, the matter of being housekeeper of a place as large as mine calls for definite qualities, you understand, of course.
I'll always do my best, sir.
Well, one certainly can't ask for more than that, no, indeed.
Your wife, maybe she'd like to talk to me?
My wife? Oh, yes, of course. I wrote you about my wife, didn't I?
Yes, sir.
Well, my wife is out shopping. As soon as she returns, you will meet her. I'm sure she'll find your recommendations as satisfactory as I did.
Makes me very happy. I've always wanted to work in a fine harbor.
Now, about money.
Oh, any salary you want to pay me, Mr. Stewart, it's all right. I just want a chance to show you how good I can do your work.
Very commendable, yes, indeed, very commendable. But we must agree on a salary. I'm the sort of man who has respect for money and expects a similar respect in others. Oh, yes, and speaking of money, you'll be wanting to open a new bank account, I suppose.
Bank account?
Yes, it's my principle that everyone employed by me should have a savings account. Builds character. I'll open an account for you in the morning. You can transfer any of the bank accounts you have back in your hometown up to my bank. Convenience, you know.
Oh, no, sir. I haven't got that.
Hmm?
I haven't any money in the bank back home. I took it all out.
Oh.
It wasn't much anyway. I got what was left of father's insurance money after my mother died.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, now then, supposing you leave all your things here and we'll go look over the house, hmm?
That'll be very nice.
Right through this door.
I'd be glad to be working in such a big house.
Right this way. Oh, yes, yes, quite an establishment here. Designed it all myself.
I work hard, Mr. Stewart.
Oh, yes, yes, I'm certain you will. Now then, right down these stairs. I'll show you everything downstairs first.
You have a washing machine?
Huh? Oh, yes, 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 everything modern, everything convenient. High, wide basement. There you are. Now, watch yourself. It's just a little dark down here this time of day.
Oh, it is a big basement, all right. Could hang up plenty of washing down here.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. Now, if you'll just come this way.
You building something down here?
Building? Oh, yes, yes, indeed. Always building, always changing, always remodeling. Change. My hobby, always changing things.
Hard to keep clean.
Now, don't you worry about that. Everything will be cleaned up in short order. Bags of sand and concrete mixer, everything will be out of the way. Won't bother you at all. No, not at all. All right, this way.
You're making more rooms?
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. With nice, clean, concrete floors. Here, look at this one.
Kind of dark.
Oh, come on, get closer. All my own work. You see, the floor is still wet. I like concrete, don't you?
Yes, it is clean.
Yes, covers everything. You know how deep that concrete is? 3 feet deep. Yes, ma'am, 3 feet deep. And I just poured it an hour before you honored me with your presence. 3 feet. That'll make a mighty thick slab of stone, won't it, Miss Nord? Thick enough to cover you. Yes, indeed. A fist to the point of the jaw, still a most effective soporific. Well, you're quite a light woman, my dear Miss Nord. Up you go, and in you go. Face down. What an unusual bed you lie in, Miss Nord. Sinking down and down and down. And the concrete will harden. And I guess I will have to get myself a new housekeeper.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's lean back now and relax for a moment. Let's take time out from tonight's amazing lights out story. The story of a strange, mysterious mansion and the one woman who entered those doors and was never seen alive again. Let's turn during this brief intermission to a much more everyday situation and a question that's much easier to answer. An angry girl is storming out of her friend's house. And her friend says,
"What can be wrong with Lucy these days? She crosses a bear and she's losing so much weight she looks terrible. She's just no fun anymore."
Well, you know what that well-known nutrition authority says about how improper eating due to wartime living may cause a person to become deficient in vitamin B1 and iron, and how you absolutely need enough of them to keep your right weight and energy.
Well, come to think of it, That was Ruth's trouble when she got so run down. So she took ionized yeast tablets. And you know how grand she looks and feels again now.
Yes, friends. Any number of people who, due to vitamin B1 and iron shortage, were losing weight, losing strength and energy and interest in life, tell how ironized yeast tablets help them regain glorious pep and strength and needed pounds. So if you're short vitamin B1 and iron, don't wait. Go to your druggist this very night and say,
"A bottle of ironized yeast tablets, please."
And now back to our lights out story of Murder Castle.
Hello, is this the employment agency? This is Mr. Stewart. Mr. Henry Stewart. I'm interested in employing a nurse for my child. Someone preferably unattached who can live here with my wife and myself. No, just send me their names, addresses, and references, and so on. I'll send you a check for the services. My address is 424 East 7th. Yes, that's right, just their names and addresses. Yes, I'll send you a check. Goodbye. Oh, yes, I'll be there. Yes, what is it?
Is Mr. Stewart in?
Oh, yes, indeed. Won't you come in? I'm Mr. Stewart.
Thank you.
You're answering in regard to...
Secretarial position. You wrote me a letter.
Oh, yes, indeed. Won't you step in here, please?
Thank you.
Now, you sit there, I'll sit here. We'll get better acquainted. Put your suitcase down there in the place, so... Now then, I'm afraid I didn't quite get your name.
Ray. Betty Ray. You wrote me.
Oh, yes, of course. I remember you distinctly. Now then, you have my letter to you just to sort of refresh my memory on the circumstances, don't you know?
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
Eh?
I didn't bring it with me.
Oh, well, then suppose you tell me a little more about yourself and all that's happened. Mother and father see you off the train, I suppose?
Oh, no, sir. It's the way I wrote you, Mr. Stewart. I'm quite alone.
Oh, yes. Well, but first there's the matter of the surety bond. I wrote you about that, didn't I?
Yes. Yes, you did.
Ah, yes, I felt quite certain of that.
Mr. Stewart, I was wondering...
Yes?
Have you had many secretaries?
Why do you ask that?
I want to know.
Why do you ask that question?
And what happens to them after you hire them? Tell me, what happens to them?
Young woman, just who are you?
My name is Betty Malone.
Malone.
Betty Malone. My sister Ella came here a month ago about a job, and I want to know where she is. Do you hear me? I want to know where she is.
I don't think I quite know what you're talking about.
Why do you lie to me? Why do you lie to me? She was here. She was.
Oh, then what makes you so sure?
A letter you wrote her. The first one. I waited a whole month, and then I came here. And as soon as I saw you, I thought something was wrong. And now I know there is. My sister Ella, where is she? You've got to tell me.
What if I tell you again that I don't know what you're talking about?
I'll go to the police. They'll make you tell the truth. I know she came here. I know she did. Why do you laugh? Why?
Because you're being a very foolish young lady. Very foolish indeed. There's no need to get excited. Of course your sister's here, and very happy too.
She's here?
Yes, and very happy too.
So then take me to her. Please take me to her.
All right. No need to get excited. Of course I'll take you to her. I intended to all along. I was just having a little joke with you.
Is she all right? Is she
all right? Of course. Now then, come right along with me. Come right along with me. Right along with me. Yes, she's right up here. Been with me for over a month.
Why didn't she write? Why didn't she tell me?
Now then, right down this hall, and you can ask her that for yourself.
This isn't a trick, is it?
My dear young lady, you have easily the most suspicious mind of anyone I've ever met. Why, I'm quite a helpless old man, and you always have recourse, as you put it, to the police. Here we are, right in this room. Now, go right in.
All right. Wait, it's locked.
Well, knock on the door, and she'll open it for you.
Ella? Ella, it's Betty. Let me in, darling, it's Betty.
What do you know?
Ella, please. It's Betty, your sister Betty.
Well, now, she certainly is a tight sleeper.
But she can't be sleeping. Open the door. Please open the door.
All right, no reason to get excited. Well,
quickly, open the door, quickly.
Now, don't excite yourself needlessly. Well, I'll go ahead. You open the door.
Ella, it's Betty. Ella, what?
Now then, my dear Betty, we understand each other clearly, don't we?
Ella. Dead.
Nothing like a complete understanding now, is there?
Ella. Dead.
Oh, it wasn't so difficult. I shut the door, sealed it, and nature took care of the rest.
Ella. Dead.
She died quite easily. Much easier than others.
Why?
You mean, why do I do it? It's a very simple explanation, young woman. This is my business. Yes, yes, my business. Some men make their fortunes in stocks, some bonds, some in business. And this is my business.
Why
is any business conducted? Profit, my dear. And I've made quite a neat little profit. Oh, yes, and a very safe one, too.
You're dead.
Yes, and you're the very first to come wandering about looking for one of my customers. The first. And I assure you, the last. Oh, yes. 30 women have come in my front door.
Ella.
31, including you and Ella. Come on along.
No.
I'll tell you all about them. You'll find it most instructive. Yes, indeed. Now, come.
Don't hold my arm.
Oh, but I must. These corridors, they twist and turn. Oh, yes, it's best I hold your arm. Get lost easily around this house. My most interesting house.
Where are you taking me?
Yes, there were 30 before you. Most interesting array. I used to read the want ads in small town papers, and then I'd write letters. Oh, most interesting letters. I needed a secretary, a housekeeper, nurse, excellent salary, unusual accommodation.
Somehow I knew this had happened.
Yes, indeed. And they brought all their worldly belongings with them, generally in a suitcase. A little here, a little there. Oh, I'm sure it's been most profitable. Now, in this room, for example...
No, don't open that door.
No, perhaps it would be better not to. The one in here came to be my housekeeper. Oh, let me see. How long ago was it? Oh, well, no matter. She came as a housekeeper, and after she went into a retirement in that room, I found in her suitcase such interesting bonds. Why, I tell you, my eyes fairly popped right in my head. Oh, yes. It's the uncertainty that makes my little business so very fascinating.
Killed 30 women.
Now, let's go down a little way now, down here. Don't make me pull you along.
Killed 30 women.
It wasn't difficult. Most women are such fools, anxious to believe what they want to believe.
They came here for life, and you gave them death.
Ah, you're the smart one. That's why I'm even bothering showing you my work. I never did the others. And showing you around won't do harm. You won't be talking long.
30 women died.
Now, in this room... let me open it and show you.
No, don't make me look. No, please don't. No.
Oh, you see? There's no reason for excitement. Just an empty room. That's what she thought when she went in here. Then I pressed this button, so. And the floor flopped open as she stood on it, and down she went. Down, down, down. Guess into what? A pit of lime. Oh, yes, I tried out so many different ways of killing them. You wonder why they'll never find me out? Well, I'll tell you why. Because I'm much too smart for all of them. Oh, not perfect crimes. No, nothing infantile, but just cleverness in choosing the women I do my business with and an equal cleverness in doing away with them. Yes, indeed. Now then, what was I telling you? Oh, yes. Why, they'll never get me.
Ella, seeing you, it's done things in my head.
No corpus delicti. And if there is one, no evidence of violence. Ah, there, that's the secret.
Were you very frightened, sister?
Pearl of quicklime, there's no corpus delicti. After that, I can tell you. Not when you bury them in a slab of concrete. Ah, yes, that's the secret.
If I could only have been with you, little sister.
Now, this room, let me show it to you. I think this will be your room, my dear.
Oh, very frightened?
You see the door? Airtight. Airtight, yes, indeed. I'll open it. The room. Amazing sight, isn't it? No doors, no windows.
I could have helped you, Ella.
Now, I'll shut you up inside the room, then I'll close the door and press this button here like this. You hear that, little one? You hear that? Pumping, pumping, pumping. And guess what is pumping?
Ella, my head.
Air. You hear me? Pumping the air out of the room. Yes, that's clever, isn't it? You breathe, and soon there'll be nothing there to breathe, and then you'll die. And if the police do find your body, no mark of violence, nothing but asphyxiation. A most mysterious death, they'll say. In time, they'll decide it's all quite natural. Embolism, heart attack. Oh, they'll think up a fancy name to clear their files. Yes, indeed, they always do.
It isn't right for him to live with it, is it?
Now, first, off with the pump. Now, my dear, I think you'd better step inside quickly now so I can close the door and go about my other work. Quickly, I tell you.
No, wait.
Wait, wait for what?
I want to give you something.
What could you give me that doesn't belong to me already?
This.
Gun.
Get in there. Get in that room.
Gun. You had a gun in your purse all the time.
My father. I brought it for the man who... Ella. Get in there.
No, what are you going to...
Get in there, or I'll press the trigger. Get in there, I'll kill you.
No, don't.
Get
you.
In.
Don't. I'm an old harmless man. I was only fooling. I wouldn't hurt you for the world.
Revenge. Strike to revenge, isn't it, Ella? He said to press this button, Ella. The pump. It's running, Ella. Listen to it. It's killing him the way he killed you. It's right to revenge, isn't it, little sister? Fight to revenge. 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 Fight to revenge.
The air. It's going out. The air. Shut off that motor out there. You hear me? Shut off that motor. Pumping out the air. Pumping it out. The pipe. Air going out. I can't reach the pipe. Shut it off, you devil out there. Shut it off. It'll kill me. Kill me. It's getting thinner already. Shut it off. I'll give you anything you want. Shut off that pump. I can't die. I won't die. I'll tear the walls down. Let me out of here. Air. Man's got the web here. Let me out. Let me out. Well, my ear. Can't hear. Drums breaking. Blood in my mouth. My eyes. No air. Bleeding. Air. Give me air. Breath of air. Air.
Revenge. 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 Revenge.
Revenge, 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 revenge. Yes, listen to her,
revenge,
Captain.
Revenge.
Over and over again.
Revenge.
Such
revenge,
a young and pretty
revenge,
girl.
Revenge. Revenge.
What could
revenge,
have driven her out of revenge, her mind crazy like revenge, that?
Revenge. Revenge.
What, I ask you?
Revenge. Revenge.
Well, Mr. Obler? And I suppose they all died happily ever after.
You put things so sweetly, Mr. Martin.
Mm-hmm.
The dark corners of the human mind are the deepest dark, I believe, of anything in the universe.
I thank you for joining me this week. And I hope those hairs on the back of your neck calm down soon. I expect that Mr. Dolan will return next week with more wonderful old-time radio. So be sure to check in next time. Well, it seems that my time here has run out. And so, I bid you all farewell.